I'm Leyte Su, host of Word of Mouth. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Michael Emeco here. It's Food Talk yet again. The month of November. Go Mets! Yeah, I know. That was kind of sad. That was good. Well, they won one game. They really kind of blew it. I hate to say this. I'm not a baseball fan. Okay, I profess to know next to nothing. I don't really, didn't even watch till like the series before the World Series. But it was the Mets, and you have to watch them. They're perennial underdogs here in Gotham City. The Yankees, of course, the big guns in town. But the Mets, they looked amazing coming into this series, but God, Kansas City just was a better team. I hate to say it. Am I allowed to say that? They really were. They just played better ball. Oh, well. Maybe next year. And that music you just heard, that music, that whoa-oh-oh-oh thing, I met one of the guys in the band last night. He's got a show here on Heritage Radio, and he's like 6'5", with a beard halfway down his chest, hair just as long, like behind his ears, a big cowboy hat, cowboy boots, skinny as a rail, and, drumroll, he's from Oklahoma, so he's allowed to rock that look. Liz told me his name 3 times already, and I keep forgetting it, but he was cool. I liked the guy. I liked him. He's total Okey from Muskogee kind of looking guy. Although that look could be a fake look out here in Brooklyn. You never know. A lot of guys posing as Okies, but he's an Okie. All right, let's get straight into the show today. We've got 3 guests again. I've been doing this the last couple of weeks, booking 3 segments per show rather than the usual 2. So we'll skip my normal stuff in the beginning and go straight into it. So who are my 3 guests today? Let's see if I can remember. First guest in a second is going to be Marco Di Giulio, and he's going to help me with this pronunciation of that. We're going to talk about... He's a winemaker, and it's just something I don't usually talk about. Ready? Winemaker from, drumroll, California. I drink 95% old world wines. I am pushing myself, asking all my Somm friends, get me into drinking more American wines that I can afford. Just so I can expand my palate into that. There's some great winemaking going on all around this country today. So my bias is purely because I'm an old guy and I grew up drinking old world wine. And honestly, the price point, like that $15 to $35 range, is just so chock full of French, Italian, Spanish, Greek, Sardinian, Sicilian wines that it's hard to resist. But anyway, we're going to talk about what he does out in Napa, winemaking styles, and also Thanksgiving pairings for wines. After that, I've got some chefs. I've got Brian Oliberg in. He's from the Red Lion Inn up in Stockbridge. We're going to talk about what's going on up in the Berkshires, the whole Berkshires food scene. And he's got another chef with him who I'm going to get her name when she's here. They did an event last night at the Beard House, and they're on their way back to Boston, or I should say the Berkshires, after this show. So we're talking about what's going on. This is a really kind of cool food scene. I mean, this isn't surprising anywhere in America these days, but there's a really cool food scene up there. We're talking about what's going on, coffee shops, butchering, local ingredients, how it all started, how old it is, what they do, what they're cooking, blah, blah, blah. And then my last guest number 3, is an old friend of mine, Jacques Capsudo, owned Capsudo Frères in Tribeca for years and years, one of the early Tribeca restaurants. Him and his 2 brothers ran that place for years. And now he's got another career. Jock has got to be, I don't want to guess, but I'm saying mid-70s, easy. And he's been talking to me about this as long as I've known him, about wanting to open up a winery in Israel. Well, he's lived that dream as his 3rd career. His restaurant is sold. Sadly, we've lost one of his brothers years ago to cancer. But Jock planted vines on a really beautiful piece of land. He'll talk about it in Israel. We'll talk about what it's like, why he did what he did, where he's doing it. But let's go straight to guest number 1. Marco, are you there?
I am here.
Sorry, did I butcher your name?
Marco Di Giulio. You did not. No, you got it pretty much right.
Almost right. Sorry, because I also can't read my handwriting. So congratulations. We're just going to roll back the tape a little bit. We're going to get to Thanksgiving wine pairings. We're going to get to Girard Winery, which is, are you the winemaker still or a consultant now?
So anymore, I actually oversee winemaking for all the wineries in our portfolio. Glenn Hugo is our day-to-day winemaker at Girard. I was hands-on winemaker there from 2001 till about 2009.
And you're a grad of UCal Davis?
Yes, exactly.
Back in the...
My goodness, I don't know, the cobwebs. Let me brush them away. Somewhere in the mid-80s, 85 I graduated, 1985.
So kind of, I mean, just take us back in time in California in 85, because I don't pretend to be an expert on California wine history, but that was kind of when this kind of big push began to happen, no? Quality-wise, and but a lot of it was centered around UCal Davis and its graduates.
A lot, yeah. So 1985, little bit of a lull in the industry back in the mid-80s because of slower time in the economy a few years before that. We always, the industry here always tends to lag a year or two behind the general economy. So a bit of a slow time, handful of people graduating from Davis, myself included, sort of got the benefit of that in the sense that that we were able to kind of hit the ground running, you know, when things aren't going particularly rapidly, you can maybe make a bigger impact right away. And yeah, it was sort of a bit of a transition point, I would say, between sort of the more old school, seat of the pants sort of viticulture and winemaking to something a little more focused, maybe, both scientifically and from you know, a marketing and sales standpoint as well.
Yeah, that's do you know Pascaline Lepelletier, the Master Somm?
You know, I know the name. I've not
she's
met.
Great. So she's a friend of mine. Lives in New York. She's the sommelier at Rouge Chaumont and a great friend, and is obviously Master Somm, so enough said. But yeah. I remember like talking to her about the American wine scene versus Europe, and she said, Michael, would you shut up already? She said, Michael, I'm from the Loire Valley. You go to Loire Valley, these people have been working the soil there for 7, 8, 10 generations. Same thing in Alsace, same thing in Bordeaux, Burgundy, etc. She said, America, really, the way she sees it, is it's kind of almost in its third generation now, with the pioneers being the guys in the late 1800s, before Prohibition, sort of going out there and planting and sort of starting viticulture, and then Prohibition shut everything down, World War II, so there was like a 40 or 50 year just dead period. And then that sort of second push that began to come around about UCal Davis, where it was like very scientific, very precise, very clean, a whole different way of making it, and you guys are like kind of in that stream somewhere, like generation number three.
Yeah, I totally agree, and I mean, I think it really does play into. It's why I struggle at times with direct comparisons between sort of old world wines and winemaking versus California, because of that. I mean, they've got a fantastically rich history, and with that comes a level of knowledge with regard to vineyards, especially that we frankly just don't have. And we're working hard. We're trying to get there, and I think we've made some real inroads in the last 30, 40, 50 years. But realistically, winemaking is a very slow process, and it takes a long, long time to understand the impacts of various decisions that you've made. Because not only do you have to wait for the grapes to grow and the wines to be made, but ultimately for the wines to age a fair amount as well in order to really see, have you created something that's got some longevity or not?
I mean, you're correct. Right. It's so frustrating because, I mean, just think of vines that you've planted. I mean, some of your vines are the middle-aged, older vines can be 30 years or 40 years old at this point. And, yeah, right. I mean, so it takes a full calendar year, from fruit from bud set to flower to bud set, the whole cycle, those five cycles to get you through to harvest. And then in the case of red wines, you then have the harvest, you have the fermentation, you have the aging en barrique or in oak for a couple of years, bottling, often it sits for another year or so still after that. And so now you're 4 years in, and it's still kind of an experiment that you might not see the results of fully for 10 to 15 years out.
Right, and every year is a little different, so it's not as though you can just systematically, year in and year out, say, I'm going to change this one thing, and then I'm going to see how it differs from the last year. Well, you've got so many other variables that have changed with no impact from you, just nature providing the excitement for you, that it's really hard to draw direct conclusions from a lot of the things that we've done.
Yeah, I think I've been drinking wine my whole life and kind of travel a lot and film. I've got a PBS show that airs out here, and we just got back from filming the Bordeaux harvest, the 2015 harvest. It turned out to be a great year. Everybody was thrilled in September. But again, to your case in point, because we're going to get to your wines, a lot of what you're doing is a lot in the red wine space and the white wine too is of Bordeaux blends. Your Artista Bordeaux blend is straight up classic, almost like a left bank blend in a way, but not precisely. But I'm walking to the vigneron there, and I'm walking with the big ones and the small ones, and yeah, the same, like they have been on that soil for so many generations that they just have it down. They know what to plant where, what works where. You know, the left bank tends to be gravelier and gnarlier and mostly Cabernet Sauvignon. There is some clay. They'll plant Merlot there. The right bank, more clay, limestone in both, but slightly for tempered. So, I mean, they kind of have it down. One of the things that interested me about what you're doing with Girard is that selection of what to plant where. Do you want to talk about that? Because, you know, I think people think of Napa as this one monolithic thing, like, oh, Napa, oh, I got it. No.
Right.
You've got elevations, you've got totally different soil types, totally different exposures. So talk about why you've chosen to plant what you have where you have.
Well, yeah, you bring up a very good point, Mike, and the reality is that Napa is, for as compact a valley as it is, it holds within it a great span, great variety of soil and exposure and elevation. That's why there are 14 different viticultural AVAs and potentially more coming as we better understand what happens in all the different parts of Napa. We get better at delineating which areas are best for what. And it's a 30-some-odd mile long valley, roughly, north to south. And along that length, you basically go from a relatively cooler climate down by the San Francisco Bay in the Carneros region, which is ideal for things like Merlot, and if you're into that kind of thing, Chardonnay from Napa, potentially some Pinot Noir as well.
Mm-hmm.
We don't do a Napa Chardonnay, so I joke about it.
I know. I heard you chuckling. Come on, no jokes. Yeah. No joke about oaky. No, we're going to go there.
That's right. All the way up to Calistoga, you know, which is quite warm and just ideal for more rustic varieties like Zinfandel and Petit Sirah, and scattered in between are just all of these wonderful little microclimates and soil profiles that bring out all the nuance of the traditional Bordeaux varietals like Cabernet Sauvignon, Cab Franc, Merlot, Malbec, etc. And basically what I've tried to do is leverage what experience I have, which, you know, at, you know, getting about 30 years now, in the grand scheme of things is not a whole lot, but, you know, I've been fortunate to have been exposed to a lot of really excellent growers along those years, and have sort of developed, I think, some idea anyway of what grows, where Cabernet or all these different varieties grow best, and maybe more importantly, have established some really great personal relationships with these growers to allow us to source from a wide variety. You know, for Girard Winery, we buy grapes from 30 some odd growers scattered around the Napa Valley.
And in your Bordeaux blend, again, is it Artista? Is that the name? Artistry? Or how do I can't remember.
Artistry.
Okay.
Yeah.
So this is your Bordeaux blend, which is straight up. I mean, again, we just got back from Bordeaux. I've been drinking Bordeaux because I'm way older than you. I'm pushing 60 at this point. Very, very close. So, you know, if you were a chef in America in the 70s, 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 and 80s, and 80s, working in the great restaurant, all French, and the wine lists were all Bordeaux, Burgundy, and Champagne. That's just, and they were affordable. I mean, shocking. You look at wine lists from the 70s and 80s, and you're like, are you kidding me? You know, you could first gross for like $28. What? Like in a restaurant? Are you kidding? Not anymore. But yeah, so your Artistry blend varies a little. I think I have two bottles that I tasted, the 11 and the 12, but about half Cabernet Sauvignon, not a whole lot of Merlot, 8%, less than 10%. 13% Petit Verdot, which surprised me. Cab Franc was in there somewhere.
About 9 in the 12. So the
and Malbec, too.
Changes significantly from year to year.
It does, okay.
We've had years where the Cabernet has been as low as 51 or 52%. Other years, it's been as high as almost 80%. You know, the Merlot in the 2012 that you're referring to, yeah, it's 8%, but we've had years where it's been as much as 30 or 35%. So there's no set rule to that. Really, the only constants for the Artistry blend are every year it's at least 50% Cabernet Sauvignon, because it's just sort of the nature of what gets grown in Napa, that in order for me to be able to put together a blend that's a, you know, reasonable enough size, it's got to have to be predominantly Cabernet Sauvignon. And I always want to have at least some of all five of the traditional blending varieties in there. And after that, kind of all bets are off. I mean, really what I'm looking for is a consistency in style, a consistency in character. We want to be able, for somebody for who's a fan of our wines, who wants to put together three or four vintages or more, that they can taste them one against the other. And they won't taste identical. They won't taste as though they're all made the same way, but there will definitely be a thread of continuity across all of them that speaks to the style that we're shooting for.
And talk about that, because I mean, I have my tastings. Talk about that style of continuity, because that's where, if Cabernet Sauvignon is going to be driving it, but Merlot can be as little as 8%, can be as high as 35%. That's a big swing in terms of a profile for one grape in a blend. Yep. So talk about that last statement. Just put a point on it.
So the point is really that because vintages can vary so dramatically, and the two wines that you brought up are a great example of that, the 2011 and the 2012 are a great example of how different vintages can be in California. Now, granted, a little less different, perhaps a little less wildly different than some other.
Thank you. All my friends in Europe are going, oh, good, please.
happy for me.
Yeah.
But still, some variation.
Yep.
11 being a very cool year, a very wet year, 12 being much warmer, and every year having its subtle variations and changes. And so in any given year, some vineyards are going to perform a little better than others. Some varieties are going to show in slightly different ways. And we vinify all of the wines separately. So every vineyard, and in fact, in the case of some vineyards, every individual block within the vineyard comes into the winery separately, gets fermented separately, and gets put down to barrel in a mix of barrels that corresponds to the qualities of that particular vineyard block separately, and then aged through, I'd say three-quarters of its time in barrel separately. And come the spring of the year, 2 years after. So if we're talking about this year's harvest, 2015, and spring of 17, we'll sit down and work on putting this blend together. And we'll sit down with 30, 40, 50 different wines that have been aged separately. We'll have three or four previous vintages of artistry there at the table with us, and we'll just slowly but surely work our way through the blending and try to come up with something that first and foremost speaks to the fruit, because that really is what drives California wine, in my opinion.
Yeah, that was my tasting notes were the first capital letters FRUIT. I mean, it's right there. It's unmistakable. And you're 22 months and you've made the choice. And again, this is going to be snobby of me, but yeah, you've made the choice to go with a more expensive French oak for Barrique.
Yeah, it's a stylistic choice. We feel that it sort of honors the quality of the fruit that we're looking for a little better.
Yep.
It's a little more subtle, and it works for the style that we're shooting for.
Yeah, you get those wonderful, so the first thing I'm getting is I'm getting this fruit, and of course I'm getting vanilla from the oak and from the toast in the oak, and then those spice notes of clove and nutmeg, a little bit of tobacco and chocolate, but it just was dark fruit, mocha, and these really kind of supple tannins that went on. Really quite drinkable wine.
Good. Because ultimately that's what we want. We want people drinking it. And really, for me, if I had to distill our blending philosophy, actually our whole winemaking philosophy for all the wines that we produce at Girard, down to one word, it would be balance. I mean, I really do try to maintain, and I say me, but now sort of that hallmark style has been handed down to Glenn, who's our winemaker, is to try to find the right balance when we're harvesting the fruit, where we certainly have the hallmark ripeness of California Napa Valley fruit, but it's always balanced with enough natural acidity that when the wine is finished, it still retains a certain brightness, a certain juiciness that comes from that acidity. Because for me, Mike, I grew up, my family was in the restaurant business. Food and wine to me were just inseparable, and still are to a large degree. I mean, I don't think of one without the other. And so ultimately for me, wine has to be agreeable to food. It's got to be able to, sit down at a meal, open a bottle, and not just taste a glass or two, but finish the bottle and think about, hey, should I open a second one of this or something else? And so that's the balance that we're trying to look for in all of
wine. I really enjoy that wine. We don't have a ton of time. Talk to me about Zinfandel, because it's a really funny grape. I never know how to give me a Zinfandel 101, how it works and what you're looking for.
Well, same sort of thing there. You know, basically what I'm looking for is a lot of ripeness. That's and that's one of the real, you know, that sort of brambly red to black berry fruit.
Yeah, almost cherry, raspberry, red fruit. That's exactly what I had. Red fruit, cherry, raspberry.
Yep. Yeah, and so you want that, but at the same time, again, you know, for me, the acidity is the key. Yeah. You want enough brightness there that it's not just this sort of overpoweringly, you know, borderline sweet, although it's not sugar sweet, but it is just so fruity that it tastes sweet.
Yeah.
To me, the acidity cuts that, balances that. You know, it's like really good Alsatian wine, you know, where it can come across as really sweet on the palate until you get that nice zing of acidity, and then it brings it into focus and brings it into balance.
And filming there this year too, just their Rieslings drive me wild. They're great.
And you
do have that acid balance. Petite Syrah, anything but petite. Another, again, black cherry, meaty, a stewy kind of a wine. And most of your alcohol levels, your Petite Syrah, I think, was 14.5.
Yeah. So, yeah, we do strive to stay, being part of the balance. We don't want the alcohols to be out of control. They are, on occasion, on the high side, and that's, again, the nature of the sun and everything that we have here. The Petite Syrah, we do blend a fair amount of Zinfandel into, typically, to soften it up a little bit, because it can be a, you know, pretty tannic wine. In the case of the 2013, I think is what you tasted. It's 22% Zinfandel.
The skin on those grapes is pretty gnarly.
Yeah, yeah, and but we're, you know, again, we treat it in a way that, you know, try to mitigate some of that gnarliness if possible, and so we're generally pulling it off the skins before it's finished fermenting. We'll let the fermentation finish in barrel without skins, because color's never an issue with Petite Syrah.
Nope.
Yeah, exactly. We're very judicious about how much new oak we use, because we don't want it to again add to the tannin structure. So it's a lot of older oak and a mix of French, American, and Hungarian to sort of bring out all the nuance and spice of the variety.
Again, just back from Bordeaux, we were in Grave and Pessac-Léonard, tasting lots of Sauvignon Blanc and lots of Semillon in that Bordelaise style. And I really, kudos to you for what you've done, because I think you've sort of resisted that super grassy, forgive me for saying this over the radio, that sort of super grassy, super ripe, tropical, pineapple, cat pissy. A quality that I really don't like in Sauvignon Blanc. And it's a real fine balance between, you know, when to pick those grapes that are not too ripe, so you still have some acid in there for balance, and yet not ripe enough when you kind of get some of those phenols that nobody likes. This is, I didn't read the notes on the, this is all stainless, or is there any oak for Sauvignon Blanc?
Yeah, no, 100% stainless steel, never sees any oak.
Yeah, no malolactic fermentation.
No malolactic fermentation, correct.
Yeah, I mean, so you still had papaya, you still had white peach, you had that bright acid. Really, again, I mean, I could see the Petite Syrah might be a little heavy for Thanksgiving, but I'll tell you what, I love the fruit on your artistry blend. I just thought it would work so well with what's around that table, because I don't so much think of the turkey as I think of all the sides when you're wine pairing for Thanksgiving.
Totally agree. Yeah, I totally agree. That's what you got to go for.
Your Bordeaux blend was great. The Zinfandel would be great. The Sauvignon Blanc would be a great way to start the meal.
Yep. Yeah, it's great with appetizers, and it's a nice bright, nice bright acidity there. That, you know, if somebody's not doing turkey, maybe you've got, somewhat non-traditional Thanksgiving that might be a little more seafood-oriented, that's a great one to go for sure.
Well, when you get back east, do you get out here much?
I'm flying out on Sunday.
For that burgers and slider thing?
That's right.
When is that? Right. Where is it? When is it?
That is, boy, you think I'd have something like that handy, because I'm doing a radio show with you, but I don't.
You think I'd have it handy, too, and I don't, so we're both idiots, so that's okay. We flunked on that cause.
I want to say it's Tuesday night
okay.
at Bowery Hotel.
Okay. Great event. I'm out that night. I can't do it. But again, Marco Di Giulio has been my guest. He had been a winemaker. He's a consultant at Girard, G-I-R-A-R-D, Girard Winery. Really loves your wines. Thanks for coming on today. Thanks for taking the time. And hopefully the next time you're in town, we can have a glass of wine together and meet in person.
I would love that. Thank you very much for having me on the show and for talking about wine. I appreciate it.
Thanks, Sarah. All right, we're going to take a quick break, play a couple of spots. You know, these programs are brought to you a couple of ways. We bring in sponsors who love the idea that they can sort of have that halo effect of being associated with my show, other Heritage Food shows, and they pay a little bit so they can have little commercials during these shows. And we also Shout out. It's that time of year, folks. It's Thanksgiving coming up. So a shout out to all the listeners that love this show and love, I'm sure, lots of other of the Heritage content. We'd really like you guys to come on board. We've got a great new website. Come on board at some point, heritageradio.org or Heritage Net, whatever it is. You know what it is because you're here already. And anything you could donate, $5, $10, $15. We're trying to kind of up our game in terms of engineering quality, in terms of new equipment, in terms of the website, in terms of all sorts of stuff. And none of that's cheap, so we'd love to hear a little ka-ching once in a while. Show some love to Heritage, because like NPR, like PBS, like a lot of places out there that deliver content and are mostly commercial-free, we kind of rely on support and love from our listeners. So if you get a chance the next couple of weeks prior to spending all your money on holiday stuff, feel free. Heritage will take any donation you have, 5, 10, 15, 20, 50, 60, whatever. We'd love to see it. Stay tuned. We've got two more great guests coming on this show, and we'll be right back after this. Mike Hellemeco here. Everybody knows that great cooking really starts with great ingredients, and these days we have so many options to choose from. Well, I go back to the Cola Vida family brand for years, and there really is a Cola Vida family behind this brand. I got their story long after I started using their products. Back in the mid-80s, when I was the chef at the Ritz-Carlton here in New York City, one of the things you can do as a chef is order your own food. You do the purchasing, and we switched olive oils to Cola Vida. When I had my own restaurant down in Cape May, New Jersey, the Globe, for years, that's all we ever poured at the table. That's all I ever cooked with. And then when I started my PBS show in 1999, I thought, you know, if I'm going to look after underwriting and funders, why don't I go after products that I actually use at home, that I actually cook for my family with and in my restaurant with. I've been working with them for 15 years with the PBS series and now with Heritage Radio. The Cola Vida family goes back generations in Italy. They make their olive oil from great sourced olives, traceable source olives, just south of Rome in Molise province, Abruzzo, which is where my family hails from. Since then, their family's moved here, so there's Cola Vida's living in Rome, Cola Vida's living in America. It's a great, trusted family brand. It's the olive oil I use, and I'd recommend you try it as well. So if you listen to the show, you know I am a wine lover. We get sommeliers here all the time. We get winemakers. I've been drinking wine with dinner since before most of you were born. And when you think of the great wine regions of the world, I mean, what comes to mind? Bordeaux, Burgundy, Champagne, Piedmont? Yeah, okay. Well, I just got back from Bordeaux. Was there for the crush for the 2015 harvest, and I was thrilled to see, A, how the city of Bordeaux has transformed itself. It's so alive, it's so beautiful, and the region itself is crazy. There's a whole new generation of young vignerons who are coming in, and they're not making your grandfather's Bordeaux anymore. Young farmers, young vignerons that have been there for generations, that know the soil, that know the grapes. And what grapes are we talking about? You know, we're pretty familiar here. Cabernet Sauvignon, Merlot, Cab Franc, Petit Verdot, Malbec, all of those grapes find themselves in these blends. But the new style of Bordeaux wines are super fresh, super young, super clean, meant to be consumed now, not cellared for decades, because really, who has a cellar? The whites are super great. I think they're super undervalued and appreciated. Semillon, Sauvignon Blanc, crisp, dry, all stainless. If there's a little oak integration, you barely feel it. And the reds come in all sorts of styles. You know, the left bank is a little more Cabernet Sauvignon heavy, a little more structured, a little more tannic. The right bank with more Merlot tends to be fruity, a little more opened up, receives you a little bit easier. But if you've been walking past that Bordeaux aisle in your wine store, stop and grab a bottle. From $15 to $35 is some of the best value on planet Earth. With wines that are growing in one of the great wine regions, vignerons that are passionate, they know what they're doing. Give Bordeaux a second shot. I love the wines. Okay, welcome back. There we go. Shout out to Bordeaux. I do love those wines. And they are more affordable these days. We're trying to make them. Wait, okay, bingo. Sequence number two here. Chef Brian Alberg of Eat on North and the Red Lion Inn in the Berkshires. And Chef Derry Rooney, who is the chef of Meze Catering and Events. Welcome, welcome, welcome. So you guys did an event last night. at the Beard House.
Yeah, we did.
Yep.
Tell me about it. Smooth? Went well?
It was great. It was one of our actually favorite ones looking back.
One of our favorite.
Yeah.
Because the kitchen's tough. It's not so easy to pump food out of the tiny kitchen.
You know, it's...
You're worried to it, you chefs.
You get used to it.
Yeah.
I mean, you kind of walk in, see what you have to lay, and go, okay.
Yeah, and you just...
Gotcha.
You know, make it work.
So... Real quick bio. You had one point. You worked in New York. You passed through New York. You worked in Brooklyn.
Westchester.
Westchester. Okay.
Yeah.
Suburbs.
Yep.
Okay.
Yep.
From where originally?
The Berkshires originally.
Berkshire originally. Yep. And you, Derek?
I'm from kind of all over the East Coast. But Berkshires for probably 6 years or so. Yeah.
And
New
what
York
was
City.
The dish? So I saw this short video that we should probably send people to. How would they find that video on YouTube? Is it linked to something, or is it just Berkshire's tourism?
The Find Eat Drink video?
Yeah. Sorry. How would that video be accessed by the people listening to the show? It's really nicely done. It's about 6 or 7 minutes long. There's a bunch of...
Yeah, they could find it on findeatdrink.com.
Findeatdrink.com.
Correct.
Okay, and and then throw the Berkshires in. It'll probably eliminate the nonsense and pop up on YouTube or Vimeo. But you were what's the dish?
I was in that.
Yeah, but it was some dish and you didn't want to be associated with it.
Oh, the dairy burger.
That's what I thought it was, the burger. I didn't want to say that was the... So it's just like, that thing blew up and now you cannot get rid of it.
Yeah, but it kind of stuck.
Yeah.
So, but for a while I was embarrassed about the name.
Because
I don't know, it was named after me, and I don't know. It was embarrassing.
People would love to have a burger named after them. Are you kidding me? So talk about what's going on, because I love this. I mean, the video really drew me into this whole vortex. I was like, get rid of my car and just drive.
I like to think that it's more than just about food. It's about relationships and community and environment. And it's, you know, when I go to work every day, I'm passing the fields and I'm passing the animals and I'm being inspired every day. And that's what drives me in the kitchen. And I think that people get that and they sense that and they really feel like they're part of something rather than just having dinner someplace in a restaurant.
And when did this scene, I mean, kind of a silly historical question. I don't know the answer. That's why I'm asking it. But was there a couple of restaurants or a couple of chefs that were kind of at the spearhead, early vanguards, and then it grew around it? Because, I mean, when I think of New York City, you think of what Danny Myers did for Union Square, what Drew Nieperon did for Tribeca, what Roberta's, where we're sitting today, did for Bushwick. I mean, normally there's something, a stone that goes in the water and those ripples and then stuff around it. What made the Berkshires begin to coalesce?
I think that it was a function of our environment. There was, I mean, I can think of like probably 8 people off the top of my head that have always kind of lived that life. Mm-hmm. And most of the people have been in business and they're either chef owners or chefs for, you know, 10, 15, 20 years. And it's mainly because of all the buzz of farm to table, you know, in the media that it's just drawn attention to what we do. I don't think we're really, you know, we're not that unique. You know, it's just something that we've done forever and it's ingrained in us.
But it's unique to your generation, if you'll forgive me not for disagreeing, but it used to be in America, because I'm a minute away from 60. So it used to be when I was a chef coming up in the 80s, that really fine dining was in a few cities, in a few neighborhoods within a few cities. Like if you go back to New York in the 70s and 80s, it was like the French restaurants, the Lelas on the Upper East Side, and there was nothing else. It was just like diners and crap and delis, and not that they were bad, but fine dining was a specific thing. You didn't really find it in the suburbs. It was just in certain. And then in the last, you know, the 90s and aughts, it just seems like there's been so much talent, so much interest in cooking. And to your point, too, the whole farm-to-table farming thing where people going back to the land, that, you know, you guys are probably, I'm guessing, having that interest. Your restaurants are better than some of the great restaurants of the 70s because of what you have to play with.
I don't look at it as fine dining. I look at it as thoughtful food.
Right.
And I just think that, you know, back in the day, you know, French restaurants, classical restaurants, whatever, they weren't really using local stuff, but it wasn't there. It wasn't in, what's unique about the Berkshires is that it's there, you know, so why wouldn't we use it? Why would we get produce from California if we have produce growing in our backyard?
So talk about some of the relationships you have with your vendors. Because there's, again, in this short video clip, there's the cattle guy, there's the chicken guy, there's the coffee roaster, some guy making some kind of hoochie moonshiny. Yeah. Talk about some of the vendors you're buying from. Give me a face, a name, and a story.
All right. Yeah,
that one. Well, I always love the farmers that you become friends with. You're close with them. You have each other's cell phone numbers. They're out in the field picking something, and you get a text. And they're like, hey, I just found this patch of cucumbers I didn't know I had, or I thought it wasn't ready yet, but I have it. Do you want some? And you're like, yeah, send me 10 pounds. And then you change your menu for that night. Yeah. And I just think that's so cool. And that they bring you the vegetables to your back door, warm out of the ground, and it's inspiring.
You know, it's great. I mean, I'm kudos to your generation, what you're doing, because it didn't exist in America until really recently. And when I used to travel to Europe as a young chef coming up and do stages and go to the Michelin themed restaurants, that's what I saw, was the guys knocking on the back door with the mushrooms with the pine needles on them, and the guy coming with the live snails, and the guy coming with the warm eggs and everything. When you come back to America, it was like the fucking Cisco truck. It was like Baldor. Like
that stuff does happen in the Berkshires.
It does.
Yeah.
So tell me, we're transitioning from late summer. Actually, late summer's gone. We're kind of transitioning, whatever that word is, transitioning into like autumn into winter. What are you guys cooking now? What has you stoked?
Oh my God, squashes, root vegetables. You know,
Brussels
still
sprouts.
Greens still. Greens are pretty
lots
hardy.
Of greens
in
this time.
Yeah, we get local.
They
greens.
Survive the frost. Kales, collards, mustards,
Asian mixes.
Yep.
Yeah, just all of them.
What else?
Are you bringing
carrots?
Apples,
I mean, carrots,
pears,
there's
carrots, root vegetables.
There's tons.
Yeah, because that's what we're seeing in Union Square, too. And a week like this, we're giving like a free pass.
Well, what you're seeing in Union Square is from us. You know, we're a couple of miles away from the Hudson Valley. So it's all, you know.
And are you drawing dairy down from Vermont? Because I love what they're doing with the butter and the cheese.
I get some from Vermont, but we have it right there.
We have Hylon and we have Ronnybrook.
Oh, that's right. Ronnie Brooks by you.
Yeah.
Yep. Yeah, they've been expanding. They've got great, great stuff.
Yeah, they do. It's my father-in-law.
Oh.
Yeah.
Damn you.
Just plug in Ronnie.
Plug. Ching. You can find Ronnie Brooks products in the Chelsea Market and in Fairway stores. Brought to you by. We know who Mario married, so that's Coach Farms Cheese. Yep. Try that
stuff.
That's right.
That's right down the road from Ronnie Brooks.
Right down the road from Ronnie Brooks. So it's plug, you know, not your exclusive. Meat-wise, what are you guys doing? A lot of pork, a lot of beef, a lot of chicken.
Mm-hmm.
Lamb. Yeah. I mean, not so much chicken.
Yeah, that's harder.
It's harder because of legalities with USDA inspections and, you know, whatever. We don't even get into that. But lamb, definitely. Pork, definitely.
Goats.
Beef, definitely. Goats. Yep, rabbits.
Yeah, goats
rabbits.
Are big. October becomes a big goat month.
Awesome.
Yeah, goats have that weird breeding cycle where suddenly you'll see now for the next 4 weeks like a glut of goat in the market.
Yeah,
veal.
Yeah.
Cricket Creek.
Yep, Cricket Creek.
Yeah, and the pork's amazing too. I mean, again, back to what you guys are playing with, like you just think of, I can't remember last time I ate commodity pork. Once you get
So different.
Once you get a taste of foraging animals and what that meat tastes
it's
like,
unbelievable.
How beautiful it is, how it has that terroir, and then you go like you're stuck one day and you go to the supermarket and buy something in pink and you take it home and you're like
you're so
like,
angry,
right? You can't
you're
even eat.
Mad at
I can't
yourself.
Even
yeah.
buy it. I just stand there and
it's
stare
disgusting.
At it, and
right.
I'm like I can't do it.
I go for something else.
Yep.
Yeah. I know, I agree. A can of sardines or
something. Yeah, right. I was actually thinking canned fish. Is what I was thinking.
Right, when you're really up against the corner, give me some good, high quality European canned fish. Yeah. I love that stuff. So you've got a coffee roaster in town, a great baker in town.
Yeah.
So you got the baker. Somebody doing great bakery
there? Oh, yeah. Berkshire Mountain Bakery. It's
Richard
Bourdain. He was Food and Wine top 10 bakers in America, I believe.
Wow.
Right, a couple years ago.
Wow.
Yeah, really good artisan baker.
Good bread.
Which is another, again, I'll shut up after this 50th time, but like you go back to New York in the 70s and 80s, even the 90s, there wasn't a good bread. I mean, the bread was dropped off at restaurants at 5 in the morning. And
Rudy rolls.
And that's why we had bread warmers. I mean, we're serving like stale bread for dinner that was, and now like the bread scene.
Everywhere.
Everywhere you've got these crazy people just devoting their lives to getting up at midnight and working all day with yeasts and flour.
People are inspired by the craft.
Yeah.
That they're bringing back the old traditions. And
there's a kid
fun.
Around here. I'm going to eat at his restaurant next week right after this show. It's called Faro, F-A-R-O, not after the grain. But he's growing his own grains and grinding his own wheat
awesome.
In-house. Like, are you kidding me, dude?
Yeah.
Like, there's people that do that
that's
stuff
really
for
cool.
you. Yeah, it's nuts.
We have a couple of places, like in the Pioneer Valley up by us, that do grains and grind them and stuff, which I get some rye from and things like that. And it's really, I mean, you can totally tell the difference.
So how many restaurants are we looking at? I mean, I know this is, you know, we're not reading off of a fact sheet, but in the Berkshire, geographically, what are we looking at? Like, 8, 10, 15, 20?
As far as like
good,
similar
casual,
theme?
Yeah. Farm to table, that sort of what you guys are doing.
20.
How many, Angela?
15. 15.
Which is a lot. Yeah. So you go there for 2 weeks, you can eat a different restaurant every night.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And we encourage that. We encourage that. You know, I don't want you to come and stay at the Red Lion Inn and just eat at my restaurant. I'd send people to Allium, Meze, you know, Cafe Adam.
Yeah. Lots of good ones.
Yeah.
And we're all friends.
Right, exactly.
It's not a competition.
Yeah, you see that. Again, I have to tell you, whoever made that video was either you're all on crack or you're really good actors. Because everybody
play off each other.
Just get that sense of it's not about who's better. It's not about my shit's better than your shit.
No.
It's not about... It's like, we're here. We're in this together. We love this scene. That's what makes them alive.
Berkshire Pilgrimage is all about...
That's right. The dinner that we did last night was all about that. You know?
How many chefs?
Six. Yep.
Well, guys, thanks so much because you're.
Thanks for
you've
having
got a tough day. You've got to after this at some point. You're making your way back to the Berkshires tonight. So
we're
going to
go eat.
Hint to you is don't get stay out of. Yeah, go somewhere, get a good bite, eat some good strong coffee, and leave New York around 6:30, 7 o'clock.
Yeah,
because you'll get home the same time and a lot less sitting on the Cross Bronx.
That's the plan.
Well, I got to get up there. I don't know if I will this fall, and it's such a beautiful place. I mean, there's music up there. Yeah. There's
especially this time of year.
Yeah, it's so beautiful. Gorgeous. Foliage is gorgeous. Oh. It's a gorgeous place. I remember that James Taylor song, something from Stockbridge to something.
Stockbridge to Boston.
Yeah. Anyway, thanks for coming in. Keep up the great work, because it's
thank
so
you.
Neat
oh, thank you.
To see these spots in America where there's just more and more good food. Taking root, taking hold. There's a farm scene. We didn't even talk about the fish because you've got that great New England fisheries you can work with. Mm-hmm. What a great maritime fisheries, Gloucester, New Bedford.
Yeah.
But keep up the great work. Keep up the great work for this country's food scene. Thanks for coming
out. Absolutely.
Thanks for
support the Berkshires. My guests
thanks
have
for talking
been.
It up.
No worries. Chef Brian Alberg, who's the chef at Eat on North and the Red Lion Inn. And Derry Rooney, who's the chef at Medza Catering and Events in the Berkshires. Stay tuned. Jacques Capsuto is going to come on in. Yep, his third career planting vines in Israel. We're going to talk about what he's doing viticulture-wise in Israel right after this. All right, we're live again. Hey, everybody, welcome back. Great pleasure to have Jacques Capsoudou. Jacques, welcome.
Thank you.
So you were on my old radio show at least three or four times back in the day at WOR. Great to have you at Heritage. And congratulations, because you were telling me years ago, you had a great restaurant, Capsoudou Frères, in Tribeca, one of the early pioneers down there. Long run. And I remember, like, in the mid-aughts, you were telling me you had this idea. Because you've always been into wine. You've always had great wine lists. You're involved with the Compagnon de Beaujolais, and et cetera, et cetera. But you had this idea, this itch that you had to scratch of planting a vineyard in Israel.
Indeed.
And I think I remember at one point you told me you were buying the root stock, and I remember getting stories every year.
I got the coupure and the bouture, which is the root stock and the cuttings from France, and I planted in a version. Land. I'm pioneer, like a pioneer Tribeca. I'm pioneering the Western Galilee now.
Tell me, if you want to be more comfortable, feel free to move the microphone so that it's near you. So get comfortable. Just get right in front of it. Tell me about this land, because I'm reading about it. So, I mean, we just got back from filming in Bordeaux a couple of months ago. Well, the crush in September. We were in Alsace filming in the spring. I was in Sicily filming in the summer. We do a lot of
now
wine.
Now you got to come to Israel.
Now I got to come to Israel, but so germane to winemaking is soil type and planting the right
thing.
Well,
there's a lot of different soils. There's about five regions in Israel. And you have volcanic in the Golan Heights. You have clay and chalk and lime in the Galil. You have sand in the desert. And they found the grapes that were growing in the desert. And then you have the beach along the beach. So there's like four different terroirs. You know that Israel, they make wine there
forever.
Yeah. Biblical. That's probably the beginning of the wine industry in the world.
It's one of the theories. They have been for years in that whole region. Viticulture kind of came from there.
From Greeks, yeah. Turkey, Israel, yeah. Yeah. Georgia.
Yeah, Georgia's far back as we can go.
The Phoenicians.
Yeah.
The Israelis. When the Romans wanted to drink the best wine from the whole empire, and they propagated wine all over Europe, it used to be the Bordeaux of the time was Jerusalem Hills. So
tell me about the plot of land that you picked.
Well,
why?
I picked about a land in a hill, up in altitude. I'm at 2,200 feet high. I'm at 90 kilometers from the border of Lebanon. I'm at 20 kilometers from the Mediterranean. Lime, chalk, terra rossa, and there's a lot of stones made out of that material. And there's a 90-meter difference between the top and the bottom. The top of the hill is in the north. The bottom of the hill is in the south.
Mm-hmm.
There's oak trees in up and top. So I have I planted around the oak tree, so I have different exposure, and I have different deepness of land. So depending on the land, that's what I planted, the white, the reds, and I planted nine different varieties.
I want to get to that in a second. So when did you start planting the vines? What year?
I signed the deal with the land the 3rd of October 2010, and I planted the 14th of August 2011, the beginning of 2011, I got the cuttings and the rootstock from France.
Mm-hmm.
They went to a nursery in Israel. They graft them there, Omega graft, the rootstock and the cuttings, and then they went through the procedure. And by the end of August, by the middle of August, I came in pots and I put them in the land.
Talk about the varietals, because I don't want to know what's. I mean, we could talk about sort of what other people are doing in that space in Israel now. But you were pretty specific about what you were planning.
Well, in Israel, mostly of Israel, most of the industry in Israel is Merlot, Cabernet, is what sells.
It's his classic global brands of
Bordeaux.
Right. If I see another slightly oaky international style Chardonnay, I'm going to shoot myself in the head. Like, there's enough of that stuff now.
Yeah.
But that's not what you did.
No, that's not what I did.
No.
I brought, first I went into history, and I checked that those varietals are indigenous to the area. The Grenache Bleu Noir, the Mourvèdre, and the Carignan is indigenous to the area.
So we're really kind of southern Rhone, Languedoc-Roussillon.
Oh yeah, Spain.
Spain
on the Mediterranean side of Spain, then the Languedoc-Roussillon, then France.
Right.
Then Provence, Rhone. And that's what I wanted to plan. And I wanted to do something different than what everybody else is doing. So I brought Rhone varietal, Mediterranean varietals.
How many hectares do you have on vine? How many hectares? How much land? Or acres,
We
can speak English.
Hectares, the whole land is 15 hectares.
15 hectares.
And I planted 10 net.
So it's about
33 acres
right.
planted.
Acres, yes.
And I planted 9 different varietals.
What was your first vintage?
2014.
This is it. This is right now. These are the babies.
This is my baby.
What should we taste?
Now, and the wine is kosher.
Talk about that process, because I think there's so much confusion. In order for a wine to be kosher,
it has to be handled by observant Jews.
Handled meaning harvested, grape selection?
Not harvested. As soon as the grape is pierced, which starts fermentation,
okay,
that's when it has to be handled by observant Jews.
So once it comes into reception, basically. From reception on, we would say, is that fair?
From reception on, a non-Jew and a non-observant Jew cannot touch it.
So that kind of draws a line for me at the gates of the winery. Here come the grapes, it's the crush, the reception comes. Once any hands touch them, those hands are observed.
And you can touch it again once the bottle is corked.
Okay. And that's it. That's the only characters. I grew up in West Philly. It was, Jewish, Italian, and black, and people were drinking Manischewitz, and I'm like, what? We were drinking wine as Italians, and I'm like, what is this shit? Like, what's kosher wine in America?
Well, kosher wine here, they used to make sacramental wines for the prayers. So it was a sweet wine. But it doesn't have to be sweet to become kosher.
So I've got it now. I mean, I actually didn't know this. So the only for you, and is there a symbol on it, like Union of Orthodox or one of those?
Well, there is a lot of agency that gives you the certification.
Right.
Yeah, OU, OK.
Circle K, yep.
And local rabbinut there, between you and me, the rabbi is... And I'm going to say it on the radio.
Careful. There could be a guys with Uzis or whatever they come on. We might get shot on the way to the Morgenstopp.
It's a syndicate, really, the rabbis.
I know. Shush. I know that. It's an incredible syndicate. It's the mafia.
It is. I didn't say mafia, but you
but it's
said
it's a similar situation. Trust me. I used to be in the food business, and I know what kosher certification was for the OU. How much it costs? What was really involved in it? I'm like, are you kidding me?
No.
Whatever.
I don't know if it's in the 1200s or in the. They came up with a law. They didn't want Jews to drink wine with non-Jews. So if Jews drink wine with non-Jews, they're going to mix up and they're going to have relationship and it's going to... So what they do is they cooked the wine.
There was a style of kosher wine that had been boiled. It's totally destroyed.
It's called mevushol.
That's what that word is.
Okay, so mevushol in Hebrew means cooked. So what they did is they cooked the wine to evaporate the alcohol. So now non-Jews and Jews will drink the wine together.
Miserable. Why bother? Like, it's so funny, right? Like, it's like the last thing in the world you could... A bad bottle of wine, you say it's cooked, and not corked, but sometimes it's cooked. If you can tell it's seen heat and it's shot, it's cooked wine.
But now what they do is they don't cook the wine. They flash pasteurize it. They bring it to 165 degrees for a couple of seconds and then bring it down.
Yeah, but I'm...
Once it's pasteurized, mevushol, anybody can handle the wine.
But we're not talking about that. Your wine is nothing. Your wine's actual wine that I want to drink at the table, where I've got the polyphenols that I want, I've got the fruit tones that I want. I mean, wine that I'm going to enjoy as a consumer of wine. I'm Italian. I don't The whole flash pasteurization kosher thing doesn't matter to me.
Between the kashrut and the regular wine, there's no difference. There's no technical difference between one or the other. The only thing is who handles the wine.
Gotcha.
Okay.
So this is amazing. So this is your third career, second career? I mean, you were, I'm not going to, you know, point to your age, but I mean, you're starting this business after...
They call me in Israel a 70-year-old chalutz. A chalutz is a pioneer.
That's what they're calling you in Israel. That's great.
A 70-year-old pioneer.
That's amazing.
And
let's taste something. And Pamela, help us here. Pour something
okay,
into a glass.
Okay, now let me give you give him the rosé first.
Okay. So what Jacques says, we just... Yes, sir. Sir, yes, sir.
So I planted in Israel 9 different varietals. I'm okay. Reds. Reds is Grenache Noir. 2 clones of Grenache Noir. Mouverd. Syrah. Senso. And a tiny bit of Counoise.
All of these could be in this? No.
No.
What's this?
I'm going to give you a second. This one is mostly Senso.
Okay.
Grenache Noir and Mouverte.
All stainless?
Huh?
All stainless. 100% stainless. Of course.
Stainless. No oak.
Right. Do you do any oak on any of the whites? No.
On the white, no oak on any of the wine. Only one wine I did with the... And I did with all barrels. I wanted the oxidation, but not the flavor.
Are you selling this in the States now?
The wine is in the States. The rosé and the white is in the States.
Where in New York would we find this?
Uptown, 96th Street, 67th Street store.
67th Street Wine and Liquor, Wine Spirits?
City Winery.
City Winery down on Varick.
Tribeca Grill.
Drew has it. Okay.
The L'École.
L'École, the French Culinary Institute. Yeah, I got you.
Boulou Sud.
Yeah, up on 67th Street, right by across from Lincoln Center.
From Lincoln Center.
Yeah. Michael Madrigal is a sommelier. Wonderful guy. Georgette, Georgette Farkas. Brasserie Georgette. Or whatever it's called. Rotisserie Georgette, excuse me.
Those are the restaurants. Where did I find
you must be so excited to be doing this now. I mean, this is like a life. When did you get this idea in your head? Because
I wanted to make wine for my retirement. I said, one day when I retire, I want to make wine. And I started working on it in 2004 when I went to Israel the first time after 30 years. And I pushed.
What's the name of this wine?
Jacques Capsuto Vignoble. And I made an appellation. It's registered under my name. And I made an appellation which is also registered. I call it Côte de Galilée Village. Instead of Côte du Rhône Village. Instead of Côte de Beaune Village.
I get it. That's so funny. Huh? So you must have been... So you were there at the crush. When did you start harvesting grapes this year?
This year I started August? The 8th of August.
Yeah, early, because it's hot. It's warm.
Well, it wasn't... we had one heat wave at the beginning, and it wasn't too bad. And then we had a second heat wave. And the second one was even worse than the first. I thought we were going to harvest a week later, 10 days later than last year. But we end up harvesting sooner because we had 2 heat waves and we had a sandstorm.
My God, you don't think of... Wow.
Now,
I've heard of everything else with vines, you know, because there's so many things that can go wrong. Sandstorms. I guess you're in that part of the world.
The white is mostly Grenache Blanc.
Okay.
There's
Marsanne?
Roussanne, Clairet, and a touch of Marsanne.
Yeah, okay. So classic Rhone.
It's a classic Rhone.
Yeah,
Côte de Galilée Village, Côte du Rhône Village, and the village is Piki Inn. That's where the Moshav is. Now Piki Inn is a city in Israel.
Mm.
In the north of Israel, when the rabbis escaped the Romans at the destruction of the Second Temple, they went to Piki Inn.
I didn't know that.
They went hiding there. So it's the oldest synagogue in Israel.
I didn't know that. I'm not big on history.
Well, I'm
American, Israeli. I drink wine and eat food. What's the last one? What's the red? I want to get into that because we're going to run out of time in a minute. And congratulations to you. So you must have been like a...
What do you think of the wine?
I really love the white. I really loved it. You know, really good fruit on the nose. I mean, if it drinks like a Rhone varietal. I mean, you'd guess that's what it was. That's what I'd guess what it was genetically.
This is what it is. It's a Rhone varietal and made in Israel.
God, this is really interesting. This is really, and this is the first year. So this is a baby vine. It's like a baby vine. Like the roots are like this big.
That's
so it's
right.
Like, I mean, honestly, the first vintage is always like, who knows? Let's face it. Let's just make wine with it.
Beginning's
luck. Only going to get better.
Beginning's luck.
This is really this. I mean, already on the nose. Super.
This is mostly Mourvèdre, Grenache Noir, Counoise, and a little touch of Syrah.
Well, an ode to the Northern Rhone, but Grenache-driven, so Southern Rhone. You have classic kind of Southern Rhone blend. You must have been so happy with this harvest. You must have been so, I mean, how long were you there? From August 8th through September?
I went there June, end of June. I bottled the two reds and another white, and then I did the harvest, and I came back October 9th. And 3 days before I came in, we picked up the Mourvèdre. And it was very difficult this year with a heat wave, and we had to balance because I don't want too much alcohol into the wine. I don't want, there's no oak.
Right.
Look, this is the white and the rosé. I called it the Cuvée Eva after my mother because she always wanted me to do something in Israel. The red wine is Cuvée Samuel, which is my brother and my grandfather on my mother's side. And the top red, which is going to be a Grenache Noir, Mourvèdre, and Syrah. Mm. And that I aged it in 3 to 4 year old barrels. So I oxidize it in all barrels so I can get the effect of the oxidation. And not the taste of the...
Of the barrel.
Of the barrel.
And the name of that will be?
Huh?
The name of that?
And that's Cuvée Marco. Mm. Marco is my father.
Okay.
And that I'm not releasing until...
Till it's ready.
God willing, Eastern, Passover.
Congratulations, Jacques. Congratulations. Congratulations. So go to the website, Capsudo. You can spell that. You can find his wines at 67th Street Wines and Liquors, on the menus.
Skyview in Riverdale.
Okay.
96th Street and Columbus.
Okay.
What's his name?
Costas
is Gotham.
Oh, Gotham. This is big. And on the menus at Tribeca Grill,
Tribeca
Bar Boulud. At L'École, that's great.
L'École, Boulou Sud.
Super.
Congratulations
on another dream.
Thank you.
We should all live so well and have lives so full. Folks, thanks for burning up an hour with us. Stay tuned. Next week, we've got three more guests, another jam-packed show. I don't know who it is. We're out of time. You'll find out next week when we go live. Bye-bye.
For listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.